business that could draw you in like a great salesman does as he effortlessly talks you right down to the bottom line. When it comes to undercover work, that kind of skill is more valuable than it might sound at first. If things start sliding sideways, your wits can sometimes get you out of a situation where your gun might just get you killed. Kearns nodded and took the file back, with a thought to himself that he should find the time to go through it all more thoroughly. There was clearly quite a bit more to this young fellow than initially met the eye. Chapter 18. Bacon. Scent appeals to the most primitive of the five basic senses. Unlike a sight or sound or even a touch, an aroma can rocket straight to the untamed emotions with no stops required at the smarter parts of the brain. You like it or you hate it. That's the designed-in depth of raw stimulation the nose is built to deliver. So amid all the other deeper thoughts that should have come to Noah's mind upon awakening, it was bacon that crowded them out to come in first across the finish line. Other wonderful smells of a home-cooked breakfast, recalling the finest mornings from his early childhood, were wafting in from a couple of rooms away. Molly was nowhere to be seen, though an alluring girl-shaped indentation was still evident in the gathering of covers beside him. He pushed back the quilt and squinted to read the clock on the far wall. 4:35, it said, with no clue whether that made it early the following morning or late that same afternoon. It might take all weekend to get his body clock reset to normal again. He slipped on his robe and pulled open the bedroom curtains. It was cloudy again, and the sun was low. Still Saturday, then.
"Are you up finally?"
he heard her voice from the doorway.
"Yeah."
When he turned, he saw she was already dressed for the day.
"Looks like you found the laundry room."
"I went out and got some groceries, too. Your refrigerator was freakishly clean and really empty."
"I eat out a lot."
"Well, I made you something," she smiled. "Late birthday breakfast. Come and get it while it's hot." As they sat together at the sunroom table, he focused on his food while she returned to chipping away at her half-finished crossword puzzle in the next day's Sunday Times.
"You like word games?" Noah asked.
"I love word games."
"Well, if you get stumped over there, let me know. Not that I'm so brilliant, but I was on the spelling bee circuit when I was a kid."
"Wow, nerdy."
"Yep, I was a late bloomer."
"Here's a long one I need to get. 12 down, one deeply devoted to wine."
He thought for a moment.
"Sommelier?" She counted down with a fingertip, shook her head. "Not enough letters. You need 11.
"I wish you would have told me that."
"Sorry."
"Try connoisseur."
"Nope. There's a gimmick this week. The answers all start with the first letter of the clue. So one deeply devoted to wine, it has to start with an O."
"Again, that would have been really useful information about 20 seconds ago. You're making it hard for me to help you, Molly."
"Just trying to keep you humble."
He finished his coffee and put down the cup.
"It's enophilist." She gave him a skeptical frown, so he spelled it out. O-E-N-O-P-H-I-L-I-S-T. Enophilist. Wine lover. The O in the beginning is silent.
She filled in the letters one by one, her lips pronouncing them soundlessly and precisely as she wrote, eyes darting to follow the hints provided by each new entry. It occurred to him that he could have happily watched her do that simple thing all day long.
"I would have gotten that," she said quietly.
"You know, if you like word games so much, I might have a better job for you down at the office."
She put down her pencil, but kept her eyes on the paper in front of her.
"I've been meaning to talk to you about something," Molly said.
She got up and took his empty plate and silverware to the sink.
"Okay, let's talk about it."
"I'm not going to be in town very much longer."
"Why?"
"I'm just not. There were some things I wanted to do here, and I've done them now, so I'll be leaving."
He sat back. "When are you thinking of leaving?"
"Soon."
Her attitude had changed abruptly, as though she was steeling herself for a discussion she didn't want to prolong.
"Look, I didn't mean anything when I mentioned a job. I know how you feel about that place."
"You didn't say anything wrong. This is just the way it is, okay?"
"Okay."
She'd busied herself in silence in the kitchen for a little while, rehanging pans and tidying up briefly, but soon she sat down across from him again, reached over, and put her hand on his.
"Cheer up," Molly said. "Go get ready and loan me a jacket. I think we should take a walk."
When he came back dressed from the bedroom, he found her at the table again with a framed sheet of his childhood schoolwork in her hands, reading it over.
"What is this?" she asked.
"That was a penmanship exercise from the 5th grade. He pulled up a chair and sat beside her. "I don't even think they teach that anymore, do they? Penmanship?"
She tilted the frame a bit so they could both see it clearly.
"They asked us to write down something we liked, obviously as neatly as we could, and that was my dad's favorite poem, the last bit of it anyway." In the upper corner was the first gold star he'd received at his new school, near his new home, in the year that everything had changed. One of his nannies had framed the paper to commemorate the occasion. The movers placed it on a vacant desk in the study when he got this place, but he was certain he hadn't looked at it a second time within those years. And it wasn't quite right to say it was his father's favorite poem, more like the old man's justification of his life set in verse. He had directed his young son to study it so he'd always know the way things really worked in this world. Noah picked it up, let his thumb brush the dust from the corner of the glass, and read each metered line aloud. "Then the gods of the market tumbled, and their smooth-tongued wizards withdrew, and the hearts of the meanest were humbled, and began to believe it was true, that all is not gold that glitters, and two make four, and the gods of the copybook headings limped up to explain it once more. As it will be in the future, it was at the birth of man. There are only 4 things certain since social progress began: that the dog returns to his vomit, and the sow returns to her mire, and the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire. And that after this is accomplished, and the brave new world begins, when all men are paid for existing, and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook headings, with terror and slaughter, return." When Noah had finished, they sat in silence. Seeing these words again seemed to have taken something out of him. Molly must have sensed the change as well. She took the frame from his hands and laid it on the table.
"Who wrote that?" she asked.
"Rudyard Kipling, in 1919. Not one of his better-known pieces. He'd lost his son in the war and his daughter a few years earlier, and I guess he wasn't so happy with the way things were starting to go in the world. This is only the last few stanzas of the poem. That's all I could fit on the page."
"Pretty heavy stuff for a 10-year-old.
"Yeah," he said. "The Jungle Book, it's not."
"And what do you think he was telling you with this, your father?"
"He told me the poem meant that history always repeats itself, that the same mistakes are made over and over, only bigger each time. The wise man knows that if you can't change that, you might as well take full advantage of it. But to me, it meant something else."
"And what's that?"
"It's a warning, I guess, about what happens when you forget common sense. You have to read the whole thing to get it. I think it means that there really is such a thing as the truth, the real objective truth, and people can see it if they'll just look hard enough and remember who they really are. But most of the time, they choose to give in and believe all the lies instead."
"I bet your father was disappointed to hear that coming from his own little boy."
"You know," Noah said, "if I'd ever had the guts to say it to him, I'm sure he would have been." Getting outside turned out to be a good idea. Noah was still aching from the thumps he'd taken the previous night, like the random pains you feel only in the days after a rear-end collision. But the cold city air and exercise were relieving a good bit of that.
They'd talked some along the way, though for the most part it had been a quiet walk. But there was nothing tense or self-conscious in those wordless stretches. He found himself at ease in her company, as if a conversation was always in progress, only spoken in other forms. She stayed close to him, at times with an unexpected gesture of casual intimacy, an arm around his waist for half a block, a finger hooked in his belt loop as they crossed a busy street against the light, a palm to his cheek as she spoke close to his ear to be heard over the din of the traffic. At 42nd Street and 7th Avenue, she gradually slowed her pace and then stopped just outside the bustling flow of Midtown pedestrians. People say you never forget your first kiss, but that wasn't the case in Noah's life. Superficial things don't carry enough weight to make a lasting memory. For him, the first kiss had faded gradually into the hundredth, the faces and names and situations long ago blending together into a vague, pleasant, collective event. A little thrill, a tentative awkwardness, those sweet few seconds of breathless discovery shared with another, and a momentary sense of what the immediate future together could hold, however brief that time would likely be. This wasn't like that. Molly looked into his eyes, and what he saw in her was a perfect reflection of a wanting that he also felt, so there was no delay of invitation and acceptance. It was a different sort of desire than he'd known before, an understanding that something now needed to be said that no language but the very oldest could possibly convey. He bent to her, closed his eyes, and her lips touched his, gently, and again more urgently as he responded. He felt her arms around him, her body yearning against his in the embrace, a knot like hunger inside, heart quickening, cool hands at his back under the warmth of his jacket, searching, pressing him closer still. With everything to see and hear around them, there at the very crossroads of the world, soaring billboards, scrolling news crawlers, bright digital jumbotrons that lined the tall buildings and blotted out the whole evening sky, it all disappeared to its rightful insignificance, flat as a postcard. That place was left outside their small circle, and if asked right then, he might have stayed there within it forever. But he felt her smile against his lips as they were brought back to where they stood by the brusque voice of a passing man who advised in his native Brooklynese that maybe they should go and get a room. A light drizzle had begun to fall, and down the block they found a coffee shop with two seats by the window where they could wait out the patch of rain. When he returned from the counter with their cups, he found her sitting with a folded newspaper, not reading it, but lost somewhere in her thoughts. It was a while before she spoke. "Noah?" "I was starting to worry you'd forgotten I was here." Molly took a deep breath and seemed to collect herself for a moment. "I need to ask you something."
"Okay."
"If we hired you, your company, what would you tell us to do?"
He frowned a bit. "You mean if you and your mom hired us?"
"It's more than just the two of us, you know that. A lot more."
"I don't know," he said. "What is it you want to accomplish again?"
"We want to save the country."
"Oh, okay. Is that all?"
"That's where we start, isn't it? With a clear objective."
"That's right."
"So?"
"Okay. Let me think for a minute."
Molly had become deadly serious. This wasn't party talk. She didn't take her eyes from his as she waited.
"I guess," he said, "I'd begin by sitting down with all these different groups and trying to focus everyone on the things they agree on. The fundamentals. A platform, you know? Make it easy for people to understand what you're about. Propose some real answers."
"Give me an example."
"Well, I don't know. Start with the tax code, since your mom is so passionate about that. How about a set of specific spending cuts and a 13% flat tax to start with? Get that ridiculous 67,000-page tax code down to 4 or 5 bullet points and show exactly what effects it'll have on trade and employment and the debt and the future of the country. And I'm winging it here, but how about real immigration reform? the kind of policies that welcome people who want to come here for the right reasons and succeed. Get the fear out of those big questions and talk about a brighter future, you know? In our business, we call it the elevator pitch, how you'd explain your whole outlook, features, and benefits if you had only a 10-floor elevator ride during which to get it across to a stranger. So start with a platform. At least that way, they can start to speak with one voice occasionally. You have no political power otherwise. And what next? He held up his hands. Slow down for a minute. No, what next? Do you see that you're maybe putting me on the spot a little here? Noah tried to take a sip of his coffee, but it burned him. It was still much too hot to drink. And what did you mean, save the country, by the way? Save it from what? She looked at him evenly. You know what. Oh, come on now, Molly. Please tell me you're not really one of those people. I know you're not. I know there was a meeting at the office yesterday afternoon, she said, lowering her voice, but not her intensity. I saw the guest list on the catering order. I know who was there. I know you were in it, and I think I know what it was about. Okay, yes. Big surprise, there was a meeting, but I wasn't there for all of it, and do you want to know something else? I don't even know what it was all about. So how could you? Then let's both find out. What? Prove me wrong. Let's go right now and find out. I can't do that. Yes, you can. We'll go to the office right now, and you'll show me that I've got nothing to worry about. If that's the case, then that'll be the end of it. You're not listening to me. I said I can't. You would if you knew how important it was. No, I wouldn't. There are a lot of things I'd do for you, but I can't do that. When are you going to grow up, Noah? I know you're not who your father is, but then the next question is, who are you? It sounds to me like you knew the answer to that when you were in the fifth grade, but you've forgotten now that it's time to be a man. I am a man, Molly, but I'm not going to risk everything for nothing. Do you want me to leave? Her voice was tight, and there were sudden tears in her eyes. Do you never want to see me again? Because that's what this means. Now they were starting to attract the attention of those nearby. That is so incredibly unfair. Did you even hear what you just said? I can't believe you'd put me in a position like that. But he had lost her already. She got up as he was speaking, turned from him without a word, and walked straight out the door. Noah watched her through the glass and let himself hope for a few seconds that she'd have a change of heart and turn back into his waiting arms so all could be forgiven. But just like falling in love with someone you've known only for a single day, those things really happened only in the movies. She was going to leave him sitting there. She wasn't coming back. By the time he'd decided what he had to do, Molly had all but disappeared into the river of weekend tourists and theatergoers flowing through the heart of Times Square.
Chapter 19. You must be out of your mind, Noah said, under his breath. He was addressing himself directly. Molly was right behind him, holding tight to his hand as he led her through the aisles and racks of designer skirts and blouses toward the store's back rooms. You're doing the right thing, she whispered. He'd elected to avoid the main lobby entrance at 500 Fifth Avenue. Too many cameras there, not to mention the sign-in desk that would make a record of the weekend visit. A private elevator led to Arthur Gardner's suite of offices on the 21st floor, and that was the way they'd be going in. The elevator had originally been an auxiliary freight lift, largely unused until its luxury conversion when Doyle and Merchant established their New York offices here in the 1960s. There was only one wrinkle in the layout. The ground floor entrance to this elevator had to be located on the next-door tenant's property, which was currently a multi-level, tourist-trendy clothing store. The employees of this shop were aware that well-dressed strangers might occasionally be seen entering and leaving through their employees-only swinging doors in the back. D&M paid the tenant a monthly fee for the easement, and executive assistants occasionally escorted the firm's more reclusive clients into the agency by this odd, private route. The idea of a semi-secret entrance added an extra bit of intrigue to the visit for some.
During normal business hours, the protocol was simply to raise your company ID above your head and quietly proceed to the rear of the store as the floor manager knowingly waved you on. Since an encoded swipe card and a restricted key were required to operate the elevator, no further checks were really necessary. This was Saturday night, however, and the two of them were dressed more like college students than business executives. Consequently, they received a good deal of extra scrutiny as they passed through, and the store's rent-a-cop tracked their progress from a discreet distance, all the way down the back hallway and inside the elevator car. So much for keeping a low profile. Noah swiped his card and the doors closed. Then he inserted the stubby cylindrical key and turned the elevator's panel switch to enable. There was no vertical line of buttons to choose the floor with. This thing went only two places, all the way up and back down again. With the click of relays and a deep ascending hum, the car set into motion. He was silently watching the wall above the doors where the advancing floor numbers should have been when Molly stepped up to him, close.
"Thank you, Noah."
"I'm not really speaking to you right now." She touched his chest and put a hand on his shoulder. He looked down into her eyes.
"I hope I'm wrong," she said. "I want to be wrong. You should know that. Now please just decide to forgive me, at least until we're out of here again."
He looked away, but after a time he nodded.
"Okay."
There was only one way to warrant a blatant breach of business ethics such as this, and that was to attribute his actions to a higher cause. If Molly was right, then a cute but quirky mailroom temp had identified a grand, unified, liberty-crushing conspiracy that had been hatched in the conference room of a PR agency. The benefits of learning that would easily outweigh the consequences, forsaking his father's trust and violating the ironclad, career-ending non-disclosure clause of his employment contract. After all, with the fate of the free world in the balance, the prospect of getting fired, disowned, and probably sued into debtor's prison should be among the least of his worries. If Molly was wrong, and no ifs about it, she was wrong, then he'd be vindicated. She'd be deeply apologetic and sworn to secrecy about this whole fiasco, and there might still be a chance to salvage what remained of the weekend. A flimsy rationale, maybe, but for the moment it helped him avoid the more troubling thought that after all he'd seen in the last 24 hours, deep down he needed to know the truth every bit as much as she did. The elevator eased to a stop, and the doors opened. The old man's office was never dark. Night or day, it was always the same, warmly lit and immaculately kept, smelling faintly of pipe smoke, black tea, and silver polish. Furnished with all his fine, precious things, from the art on the walls and pedestals to the antiques and small collections of rarities interspersed among the bookshelves, everywhere you turned there was something priceless. For him it was less a place of business than an inner sanctum of quiet meditation, and a shrine to the very real forms of happiness that money could actually buy. Few employees ever had occasion to set foot in these rooms and see these sights, but Molly paused only at the sight of one thing.
"What is this?" she asked.
She was looking at a marble sculpture on a pedestal in the corner. Noah's father had commissioned it years ago. The figure depicted was a strange amalgamation of two other works of art, the Statue of Liberty and the Colossus of Rhodes. Molly would have known that much by looking. What she'd meant to ask was, "What does this mean?" "It's the way my father looks at things. At people, I mean. Societies. The law may serve some superficial purpose, but it only goes so far," Noah said, touching the spear in the statue's left hand. "At some point, the law needs to be taken away and replaced with force. That's what really gets things done. People ultimately want it that way. They're like sheep, lost without a threat of force to guide them. That's what it means." Molly silently took in the statue for a while longer, like she was memorizing it. After a few more seconds, she drew in a deep breath, walked to the door, peeked around the corner to make sure the coast was clear, and then turned and motioned for Noah to follow.
"Let's get this over with," she said.
Weekend work was one of the many things his father frowned upon, which led nearly all of the up-and-coming employees to maintain second offices at home. This allowed them to put in the expected 70-plus hours per week while appearing to comply with company policy. It also meant that, with luck, Noah and Molly would have the place to themselves for the duration of their espionage. Down the central hall and adjacent to the conference room, they keyed themselves into the locked AV booth, where the presentation files were stored. Molly stood by him as he found the coded folders on the computer, entered their passwords, and prepared the show to be launched from a remote controller at the podium inside. When they entered the conference room, the programmed lights had already dimmed and wide white screens were descending around the walls. Digital projectors hummed and glowed as they received their data, and soon the screens lit up with an introductory slide. In the beginning, he clicked through the content fairly rapidly. This was the section he'd already seen. He paused only when Molly asked him to stop while she absorbed the content of some particular display. Without the benefit of a speaker to explain them, many of the slides and visuals were difficult to understand. Animated graphs illustrated various social and political trends, timelines ticked off progress toward unnamed goals, maps with highlighted regions expanded or contracted to show unidentified changes over months, years, or decades. "Stop," Molly said. "Go back one." They were deeper into the presentation now, past the point at which Noah had left the meeting, but nothing had seemed particularly shocking or frightening to him. He had breezed right past the screen she'd asked to see again. It was an introductory agenda for the group of very important people who'd come to attend the final half of the meeting. The heading was Framework and Foundation, Toward a New Constitution. No names accompanied the headings that followed, only the areas of government that each new attendee supposedly represented. Finance, Treasury, Fed, Wall Street, Corporate Axis? Energy, Environment, Social Services? Labor, Transportation, Commerce, Regulatory Affairs? Education, Media Management, Clergy, COINTELPRO? FCC, Internet, Public Media Transition? Control and Preservation of Critical Infrastructure? Emergency Management, Rapid Response, Contingencies? Law Enforcement, Homeland Security, U.S. NORTHCOM, NORAD, STRATCOM, Contract Military, Allied Forces? Continuity of Government? Casus Belli, Reichstag? Susanna, Unit 131, Gladio, Northwoods, Exigent. "Who was in this meeting? Do you know?" Molly asked. "The people I saw were mostly from some advanced planning division of the DHS, domestic war gamers like the international kind at the Pentagon. There's a stack of tent cards here somewhere with their names. I don't know about the ones who came later. I only had their phone numbers." "Do you still have that list?" "No, I don't. I was told to burn it, and that's what I did." He walked toward the screen and pointed to the last entry. "What does this term mean? My Latin's a little rusty." She glanced up from her notes only for a moment. "Casus Belli. It means an incident that's used to justify a war. Come on, let's keep going." The slides thereafter made continual references to pages in some briefing document that must have been handed out to the meeting's participants. Without those pages, it seemed there was little use in continuing further. "That's it," Noah said. "I don't think there's any more to see."
"It's not over yet. We're not to the end."
He held his thumb down on the advance button, and the screens ticked by more and more rapidly.
"I'm telling you, look at it. This is nothing but page numbers."
The walls went black, leaving the room in almost total darkness. One by one, the screens faded in again, encircling the room with new content they hadn't seen before. Each screen contained a linear diagram that was a trademark of the company's strategic plans. These diagrams were used to show the firm's clients a step-by-step layout of what to do, and how and when to do it. The headings mirrored the disciplines of the attendees shown earlier: finance, energy, labor, education, infrastructure, media, emergency management, law enforcement, and continuity of government. A security dialogue popped up, and with a vocal sigh, Noah entered his override password. If anyone ever checked to see who'd accessed these files and when, This would be another nail in his coffin. An hourglass indicator appeared, along with the message, "Please wait, content loading from remote storage." "It'll be a few minutes while this downloads," Noah said. "We keep some of the more sensitive stuff off-site to guard against the kind of thing we're doing right now." Molly had left her seat and walked a complete circuit of the round room, looking over the various headings on the screens. She stopped by his side, pointing out a bracketed rectangle that enclosed part of the illustration on the slide in front of them. "What's that box?" she asked. "It's called the Overton window. My father stole the concept from a think tank in the Midwest. It's a way of describing what the public is currently ready to accept on any issue, so you can decide how best to move them toward what you want."
"I don't understand," she said. She was looking at the screen related to national security and law enforcement. Except for the heading and the long, thick line with an open box near its center, the slide was mostly blank. "How does it work?"
"The ends of this long line," Noah walked up to indicate the starting point, "represent the extreme possibilities. At this end of the scale is the unthinkable, and all the way over at the other end is something else you can't imagine ever happening, but in the opposite way. Too much good here, too much evil over there. If we were talking about government, it would be too much liberty at this end, which would be anarchy, and a complete top-down Orwellian tyranny at the other, so no liberty at all. Those in-between points are milestones along the way." Molly still looked a little lost in the concept, and she motioned for him to go on. "Use airline security as an example," Noah said. 40 years ago, people could pull up to the airport a few minutes before their flight, be treated with courtesy and respect, present no ID, just a ticket, and then get on the plane with just about anything in their pockets and their bags. There was some security, but it was almost invisible. Today, that's unthinkable, right? It seems like we could never go back to those days." She nodded. "Now, at the other end of the spectrum, let's make the passengers arrive 4 hours early for the security line, allow no carry-ons, enforce a mandatory strip search, full-body X-ray, a cavity probe for everyone, and you have to stay in your seat the entire flight with a stun bracelet on your wrist in case you try to get up to go to the bathroom, which, of course, no longer exists."
"They're actually talking about doing some of those things," she said.
"Well, that's getting to my point. If you suddenly had to go through everything I just mentioned, you'd give up flying, correct? And with no security at all, you'd also never set foot on an airplane. So your Overton window is somewhere in the middle, within this box. But my goal is to get you to accept more of those radical things over there, one step at a time. Let's say tomorrow some idiot makes his way onto a flight with a little tiny homemade explosive of some kind. It'd be all over the news for weeks, whether the guy actually did any damage or not. You get scared, and the TV is telling you that all we have to do is buy some more expensive screening machines, hire some more of the same people who let that nut on the plane in the first place, and give up a little more dignity at the checkpoints, and we'll be safe. That, of course, is a lie, but it has the desired effect."
"It moves the window," she said.
"Right. We put a false extreme at both ends to make the choices in the middle look moderate by comparison, and then, with a little nudge, you can be made to agree to something you would never have swallowed last week."
"Why, though? Why would they want to do that?"
"Well, the airline thing was just a random example, but I can think of a few reasons. If my client sold those X-ray machines, or had a contract for those extra security people, there's quite a bit of money to be made there. It makes the government bigger and more involved in our lives, and that can justify higher taxes and fees, more bureaucracy, bigger budgets. It can build support for an unpopular military action, on and on. And who knows? Some of your friends last night might say that it's all part of a program to condition the American people to put up their hands and submit to anyone in a uniform."
"And this Overton window, it's used all the time?"
"All the time. Everywhere you look. We never let a good crisis go to waste. And if no crisis exists, it's easy enough to make one. Saddam's on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, so we have to invade before he wipes out Cleveland. If we don't hand AIG a $70 billion bailout, there'll be a depression and martial law by Monday. If we don't all get vaccinated, 100,000 people will die in a super swine flu pandemic. And how about fuel prices?
Once you've paid $5 for a gallon of gas, $3.50 suddenly sounds like a real bargain. Now they're telling us that if we don't pass this worldwide carbon tax right now, the world will soon be underwater. And understand, I'm not talking about the right or wrong of those underlying issues. I care about the environment more than most. I want clean energy. I want this country to recover and be great again. People should get their shots if they need them, and Saddam Hussein was a legitimate monster. I'm saying opportunists can attach themselves to our hopes and fears about those things for profit, and this is one of the tools they use to do that. The question to ask is, if they've got a legitimate case for these things, then why all the lying and fabrication?
So, even if they can't get us to accept everything at once, Molly said, studying the diagrams, they're satisfied to move us a little closer toward the end.
Exactly. In fact, without some big earth-shaking event like a Pearl Harbor or a 9/11, that's the only way it can work. Just little nudges in the right direction. And before you know it, you've progressed yourself right into their agenda. It's evolution thereafter, not revolution. And when I say they, I don't mean some secret society out there. There's always a prime mover behind these things, and it's easy enough to figure out who it is. Just do a little research to see who stands to benefit. Follow the money and power. You know who was one of the biggest lobbyists for this cap-and-trade business, right?
Greenpeace? Molly said.
Nope. Enron. A lot of powerful people are lining up to cash in on the deal if it happens. But back then it was a huge push at Enron right before the whole company blew up in America's face. Carbon trading was going to be their biggest scam since they shut off the lights in California and held the whole state for ransom. They'd already started trading futures on the weather, if you can believe that. But this heist was going to be 1,000 times bolder. Back then everybody thought they were joking.
Not quite everybody, I guess.
You're right about that, Noah said. In fact, Enron was really just a huge diversion, like a Bernie Madoff, a patsy to throw to the wolves. Carbon trading moved forward anyway. The Chicago Climate Exchange is probably the best example, especially since it's basically founded or fronted or funded by a who's who list of environmental luminaries like Al Gore and Goldman Sachs. But I can see why no one really cares. The exchange's founder thinks it's probably only a $10 trillion a year market.
Molly stared at him in astonishment. Did you say 10 trillion a year?
Uh-huh. And the backing for it goes right up to the top, internationally. So here's a little pop quiz. What do you get when you combine corporate greed with political corruption and sprinkle a few trillion on top?
I don't know.
Fascism? Noah shook his head. You get Doyle and Merchant's newest client. The hourglass on the screen had disappeared moments before and was replaced by a dialog box with two buttons, one labeled Halt and the other Proceed.
Now I know what I'm looking at, Molly said. So let's see what's next.
Noah clicked the remote, and the screens all began to change. The slides that had been incomplete filled in with callouts, numbers, names, legends, and dates to illustrate the long-term agendas within each area of American government and society at large. Some of these agendas spanned only a few years, others more than a century. Pointers along the timelines began to move. Text formed and then faded as significant events in recent history were reached and passed by. Milestones appeared and closed in the Overton window of each screen as it moved slowly from left to right. It was far too much ever-changing information to absorb, like watching all the movies in a multiplex simultaneously. But as they turned and took it all in at the center of the circle of screens, Molly suddenly touched his hand and gripped it. It seemed the same realization had come over them both at the same instant. This wasn't 8 separate agendas at all. It was only one. Along the bottom, the steady advance of time. Through the middle, the slow, sporadic movement of the Overton window, usually pushing forward but sometimes pulling back, as though the public might have rebelled briefly against the relentless pressure before giving in to it again. To the far right of each screen, a final goal was listed.
As Noah looked to each of them, he realized something else that all these endpoints had in common. They weren't written and presented as though they were unthinkable extremes, but rather as achievable goals in some new, unified framework of command and control, ready to come forth on the day the old existing structure failed. Consolidate all media assets behind core concepts of a new internationalism. Gather and centralize powers in the executive branch. Education, de-emphasize the individual, reinforce dependence and collectivism, social justice, and the common good. Set beneficial globalization against isolationism/sovereignty, climate change, debt crises, finance/currency, free trade, immigration, food/water/energy, security/terrorism, human rights versus property rights, UN Agenda 21. Associate resistance and constitutional advocacy with a backward extremist worldview, gun rights a key. Quell debate and force consensus. Identify, isolate, surveil opposition leadership, threaten with sedition, criminalize dissent. Expand malleable voter base and agenda support by granting voting rights to prison inmates, undocumented migrants, and select U.S. territories, e.g. Puerto Rico. Image as a civil rights issue. Label dissenters as racist. Invoke reliable analogies, slavery, Nazism, segregation, isolationism. Thrust national security to the forefront of the public consciousness. Finalize the decline and abandonment of the dollar, new international reserve currency. Synchronize and fully integrate local law enforcement with state, federal, and contract military forces. Prepare collection/relocation/internment contingencies, systems, and personnel. According to the progress shown, many of these initiatives were already well underway. The slide devoted to finance showed a timeline beginning in 1913, and its window had moved nearly to the end. The screen for education began at a point even earlier and was also well along. Advances in one concerning surveillance, security, and the militarization of law enforcement had accelerated radically in the years since 9/11. There's a difference between suspecting a thing and finally knowing it for certain. Noah felt that difference twisting into his stomach. You can hold on to the smallest doubt and take comfort in it, stay in denial, and go on with your carefree life until one day you're finally cornered by a truth that can no longer be ignored.
"Look over there," Molly said.
But he'd already seen it. While every other slide had shown advancement and slow progress over its individual time span, one hadn't moved at all, as though its role in all this was simply to be ready and awaiting activation. Also, unlike the others, its timeline didn't measure years or decades, but only 3 final days. Unlike the others, this slide had no Overton window. Exigent was the legend at the far end of the line, and it seemed there would be no question of public acceptance. No need to rally opinion on this front. Whatever it was, it would bring its own consensus. "Causus belli," the heading said, and Molly's translation was still fresh in his mind. An incident used to justify a war. Chapter 20. Outside, the skies were still threatening, and to accompany the frigid light rain, a wicked crosstown breeze had begun to blow. In that sort of weather, almost everyone on the street is looking for a ride, so it took a few blocks of trying before Noah and Molly were able to hail an empty cab headed downtown. When they'd closed the door, the driver turned and asked where they were going. 9th Street and Avenue B by Tompkins Square Park, Noah said. And do us a favor, he added, passing through enough of a tip to make his point. We're not in a rush, so just take it really, really easy. Understand? The man in front took the money, gave a nod in the rearview mirror, and then signaled and pulled away from the curb with exaggerated care, hands on the wheel at 10 and 2 o'clock, driving as if an inspector from the Taxi and Limousine Commission were watching from the shotgun seat. Molly kept to her side of the car, looking out the window in silence as the ride got underway, but after a minute she reached across and found Noah's hand to hold.
"There were no dates on those screens at the end," Noah said. "There's nothing to say that this thing is happening tomorrow or next week or next year."
She shook her head.
"It's happening now."
"How do you know that?"
"Because I can see it. The economy is crashing, Noah. There's no net underneath it this time. That's why they're rushing through all this stimulus nonsense, both parties. All the cockroaches are coming out of the woodwork to grab what they still can. It's a heist in broad daylight, and they don't care who sees it anymore. That's how I know.
They've doubled the national debt since 2000, and now with these bailouts, all those trillions of dollars more, that's our future they just stole, right in front of our eyes. They didn't even pretend to use that money to pay for anything real. Most of it went offshore. They didn't help any real people. They just paid themselves and covered their gambling debts on Wall Street."
She looked at him. "You asked how I know it's happening now? Because the last official act of any government is to loot their own treasury."
He couldn't think of a thing to counter that. At least, nothing that either one of them would believe.
"We'll be okay," Noah said.
"Who'll be okay?"
"The two of us. And look, I'm not talking about any commitment you have to make or a relationship or whatever. I know we just met, so let's take all that out of the picture and not worry about it right now. I'm just telling you that I'll help you, you and your mom, no strings attached."
"I couldn't do that."
"Just give it some thought. I know it would probably feel like some pact with the devil. I feel the same thing, but it's better than the alternative, isn't it? Whatever happens, it isn't going to hit everyone equally. A lot of people I know probably won't feel a thing, and I'm set up to be okay through just about anything, so I'm just saying that we can fix it so you and your mother are okay too."
"You're wrong. You won't be okay. No one will. If they accomplish half of what we saw on those screens, then money won't protect you. Nothing will."
She turned her attention back to the window and the dark, blustery night beyond the glass. After a time, her clasp on his hand tightened for a few seconds, but it didn't really feel like affection. It was more like the grip a person might take on the arm of the dentist's chair, or the gesture of unspoken things an old love might extend at the end of a long goodbye. Chapter 21. When the cab pulled to a stop, Molly opened the door and turned back to him as he paid the fare.
"Come on up," she said. "See how the other half lives."
The path to the entrance began with a forbidding metal gate at the sidewalk. The lock took quite a bit of finesse to operate. It looked as though it had been jimmied open more often than unlocked with a key. A dismal courtyard lay beyond the gate, and at the entrance a triple-bolted fire door opened to a sad little front hall lit by a single hanging light bulb. He followed as she started up 3 narrow, creaking flights. He took her occasional cues to avoid a splintery patch on the railing or a weak spot in the stairs. On the second floor, the entrance from the landing was secured with a heavy chain and padlock. His first thought was that the door was blocked to discourage squatters, but considering the run-down, gray-market condition of the place, it was probably as much for the safety of the trespassers as a protection for the property itself. Though the walls and windows showed signs of spotty maintenance, the construction was haphazard and incomplete. None of the repair work seemed up to code, but little of the older existing carpentry did either. As they continued up the stairs, he saw sheets of plywood over broken windows, and bare studs without plaster here and there. Long, jagged cracks in the remaining walls warned of some structural weakness that might run all the way to the foundation. Random drafts swept up the dim stairwell, accompanied by ominous settling sounds and the distant clank and hiss of old steam heat. When they arrived at the third floor, Molly had her keys ready, and she set about unlocking several deadbolts on the unnumbered apartment door.
"How long have you lived here?" Noah asked.
"Not that long.
She tried the door and had to put her shoulder to it to bump it free from its swollen frame. It's a little nicer inside. And she was right. In fact, across that threshold it seemed like they'd entered a whole different world. As she relocked the door, he took a few steps in, stood there, and looked around. Great effort had obviously been taken to transform this space into a sort of self-contained hideaway, far removed from the city outside. What had probably once been a huge, cold industrial floor had been renovated and brought alive with simple ingenuity and hard work. The result was one large area divided with movable partitions to form an impressively cool, livable loft. From where he was, he could see a spacious, multi-purpose room off the entryway, a kitchen and laundry to the side, and what seemed to be a series of guest rooms toward the back. Molly hung her keys on a hook by the door. "What do you think?" "How many people live here?" Noah asked. "I don't know. 8 or 10, so don't be surprised if you see someone. They come and go. None of us lives here permanently. We have places like this all around the country so we can have somewhere safe to stay when we have to travel. That's my room over there for now, but hardly any of this stuff is mine." She stepped into the kitchen, still talking to him. "Have a seat. I'll make us some iced tea. Or would you rather have a beer?"
"The tea sounds good."
"We make it pretty sweet where I come from."
"Bring it on, Ellie Mae, the sweeter the better."
He walked about midway into the front room and found a slightly elevated platform enclosed in Japanese screens of thin dark wood and rice paper panels. There were a lot of bookshelves, a dresser, a roll-top desk, and a vanity. But the space was dominated by a large rope hammock, its webbing covered by a nest of comfy blankets and pillows, suspended waist-high between the red shut-off wheels of two heavy metal pipes that extended up from the floor through the ceiling. This room within a room was lit softly by small lamps and pastel paper lanterns. The total effect of the enclosure was that of a mellow, relaxing Zen paradise. A glance through the nearest bookcase revealed a strange assortment of reading material. Some old and modern classics were segregated on a shelf by themselves, but the collection consisted mostly of works that leaned toward the eccentric, maybe even the forbidden. There didn't seem to be a clear ideological thread to connect them. Alinsky's Rules for Radicals was right next to None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Down the way, the Blue Book of the John Birch Society was sandwiched between Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book, Orson Scott Card's Empire, and a translated copy of The Coming Insurrection. Below was an entire section devoted to a series of books from a specialty publisher, all by a single author named Ragnar Benson. Noah touched the weathered spines and read the titles of these one by one. The Modern Survival Retreat, Guerrilla Gunsmithing, Homemade Grenade Launchers, Constructing the Ultimate Hobby Weapon, Ragnar's Homemade Detonators, Survivalist's Medicine Chest, Live Off the Land in the City and Country, and the last worn hardcover, titled simply Man-Trapping.
"Those are some pretty good books he's got there, huh?"
It was only the tranquil atmosphere and a slight familiarity to the odd voice from close behind that kept him from jumping right out of his skin. He turned, and there was Molly's large friend from the bar, nearly at eye level because of the elevated platform on which Noah was standing.
"Hollis," Noah said, stepping down to the main floor. "How is it that I never hear you coming?"
The big man gave him a warm guy hug with an extra pat on the shoulder at the end.
"I guess I tend to move about kind of quiet."
"I might need to hang a bell around your neck just for my nerves."
"Come on," Hollis said. "Let me show you around some."
The loft had more living spaces in back than Noah had first imagined. Some were for sleeping, others for working and meeting. In the room that Hollis identified as his own, there was a low army cot, several neatly organized project tables, and a large red cabinet on wheels, presumably full of tools. All these things were arranged as though bed rest wasn't even in the top 10 of this man's nighttime priorities.
"What is all this stuff?" Noah asked.
One table was covered with parts and test equipment for working on small electronics. Another was a mass of disassembled communications equipment, and a third was devoted to cleaning supplies and the neatly disassembled pieces of a scary-looking black rifle and a handgun. More weapons were visible in an open gun safe to the side, but his focus had settled on the nearest of the workbenches.
"Are you making bullets there?"
"Making ammunition."
Hollis picked up a finished example and pointed to a spot near the grayish tip.
"The bullet's just this last little bit on her business end. That right there's a .44 jacketed hollow cavity. Got a lot of stopping power."
Arrayed around this bench were a number of labeled bins and jars, black powders of varying grades and grinds, a pharmacist's scale, a tray of brass casings, and a hand-operated machine that looked something like a precision orange squeezer attached to the tabletop by a vise. "Why on earth would you want to make your own ammunition?" Hollis sat, put on his spectacles, picked up the components of an unfinished cartridge, started working with the pieces, and then spoke.
"Noah, do you like cookies?"
"Why, yes, Hollis. We were talking about firearms, but yes, I do like cookies."
"And which do you like better?"
He'd placed the open powder-filled casing in the lower part of his hand-operated machine, fitted a bullet on top, tweaked an adjustment ring with the deft touch of a safecracker, and then rotated a long feed lever until the two parts mated together into a single, snug assembly.
"Do you prefer those dry, dusty little nuggets you get in a box from one of them drive-through restaurants?"
He removed the finished cartridge from the mechanism and held it up so Noah could admire its perfection.
"Or would you rather have a nice, warm cookie fresh out of the oven that your sweetheart cooked up just for you?"
"I see what you mean, I guess."
"Oh, hell, anything'll do for target shooting, I suppose. But if I know what I'm hunting, I can make up something that's just exactly right, and she'll fly straighter and hit harder than anything I could buy in a box from a store."
"I'm not a gun guy, but it's hard to believe it could make that much difference."
"I'd say it makes all the difference."
After consulting his calipers, Hollis made an infinitesimal adjustment to the press and returned to his work.
"Go out sometime and wing a bull moose with a rifle you loaded for a little white-tailed deer and see what happens. Might as well just whack him on the nose with a rolled-up newspaper."
"I see."
"You better see. Nothing quite like a pissed-off wounded moose chasing you across an open field to teach a man the value of the proper ammunition."
Noah looked over the table again. In a stack near the other end, a number of clear acrylic boxes were already filled with finished ammo. "How many of those things can you do in an hour?"
"With a one-stage press, I'd reckon somewhere between 75 and 200 rounds."
Hollis looked up at him over the rims of his thin safety glasses and smiled.
"It all depends on my motivation."
"Hey, boys," Molly said. She had brought a glass of tea for Hollis. "Catching up?"
"Yeah, we are. Hollis here was just making some helpful suggestions for the next time I need to shoot a moose."